I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. The six officers charged in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray will be tried in Baltimore City, on the heels of the announcement that Baltimore will pay Gray's family a $6.4 million settlement. Circuit Court Judge Barry Williams ruled this morning that the criminal trials of the police will proceed in the city. At noon, we talked to P. Kenneth Burns of the WIPR reporting staff and Danny Jacobs of the Daily Record for the latest. Then Edward Snowden, patriot or traitor? Longtime journalist and former State Department spokesman during the Carter administration, Hodding Carter III, tells us why he changed his mind about Snowden and what the role of the press is in holding government accountable. All this on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in today for Dan Roderick. Dan's in circuit court today for the hearings on the motions in the Freddie Gray case. Later this hour, we'll talk with veteran journalist and former State Department spokesman Hodding Carter III about the role of the press in the post-Snowden era of national security. But first, as you heard on NPR, Circuit Court Judge Barry Williams has ruled that the trials of the six police officers charged in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray will be held in Baltimore. Judge Williams heard arguments at the Clarence Mitchell Jr. Courthouse about whether the six individual trials of Baltimore City police officers charged in the death of 25-year-old Freddie Gray should be moved outside the city. It was the second day of court hearings in the case. And with me in the studio now to discuss the legal aspects of the hearing and arguments today is Danny Jacobs, legal editor of the Daily Record. Welcome to the show, Danny.
Thanks for having me.
But first, we have P. Kenneth Burns of the WIPR news staff. Kenny, you were in court this morning.
Yes, I was. I would say about the same amount of national and local media was in the courtroom at Courthouse East, and then the gallery itself was. It was a full crowd last week, but you didn't really see a packed courtroom this morning when Judge Barry Williams heard arguments on whether or not to move the trials out of Baltimore.
Yeah, and take us into those arguments. The prosecution, which wanted the trials to stay here, it pointed to examples of trials held in jurisdictions, other jurisdictions where big crimes had occurred, the trial of the Boston Marathon bomber, the sniper trials. What was the core of the prosecution's argument?
Well, we can't really talk about the prosecution until we talk about the defense.
Okay, take us there first.
Yeah, and the defense, they pointed to the pretrial publicity, obviously. And they pointed out that while some of the publicity on the national scale has calmed down a little bit, at least until yesterday when the news of the settlement came out, there has been consistent and persistent coverage in the local media, pointing to several Baltimore Sun articles, pointing to as well as TV and radio. And then they point to statements made by elected officials like State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, as well as members of clergy. And then they highlighted three issues, of course, the settlement, the leaked medical examiner report that showed up in the Baltimore Sun, and the witness who Dante Allen, who happened to be charged with fraud. So those were the defense arguments. Now, as far as the prosecution, as you mentioned, they brought up the Beltway snipers in regards to the trial taking place in Montgomery County and Virginia. They brought up the Boston bomber trials, which took place in Boston. And plus, they added that the media coverage, particularly the Sun's media coverage, has not really been fair or deferential to Marilyn Mosby. In fact, Michael Schatzer, who argued on behalf of the state, said that that the Baltimore Sun was critical of Mosby since she brought charges against the six officers.
And so when Judge Williams ruled, did he indicate what argument was most important to him, what swayed him most?
He said the important thing in all of this is to make sure that each defendant, remember, there are six separate trials for those listening at home, that each defendant gets a fair trial. He pointed out in particular as far as publicity, news is delivered differently now than in the 50s and 60s. He said that citizens have instant access to different media outlets. He pointed out that coverage of what happened in Baltimore has circulated throughout the world. He also said that citizens in Baltimore are not monolithic. They could think for themselves, and that the statements made by elected officials, by clergy, matter little to residents.
You, Kenny, you made a passing reference to the settlement, the $6.4 million settlement that the city approved yesterday with the family of Freddie Gray. Did Judge Williams say anything about the how the settlement factored into his decision?
He said that the settlement did not factor in the criminal arguments, and that's where he left it. He noted it, but he said it didn't matter because there is a completely separate issue.
And he's called you all back into court for more discussion at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Do you know what will be discussed this afternoon?
We do not know what is going to be discussed at 2 o'clock this afternoon. I tried to find out a little bit more, but it could literally be anything. It could be scheduling for the trials, and it could also be other issues. But as far as specifically what will be discussed, we do not have an answer to that yet.
And at this point, I gather October 13th is still on the calendar as the first date for one of the trials. Has Judge Williams said anything that hints about whether or not that's a realistic date still?
He has not said if that was going still realistic or not, but many legal observers they're predicting that is not really reality, especially after last week's decision.
The decision for the six separate trials.
That's right.
Kenny, I appreciate your updating us. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila.
WIPR news reporter P. Kenneth Burns. And now Danny Jacobs of the Daily Record is here with me. That $6.4 million settlement from city taxpayers to Freddie Gray's family, how is that going to be structured? Do we know?
What we were told yesterday, that it's going to be paid out over 2 years, a little bit this year, a little bit next year. And the city officials have said it's not going to affect city's operations. This is not going to bankrupt the city. We'll still be able to get services done. The city sets aside money each year for police settlements. I don't think they set aside this much money, but they said things will continue as normal in the city, even with the settlement.
Do you have a sense, has the Daily Record developed a sense of the potential impact of the trials staying in Baltimore?
I think it was, in talking to people, it seems like that was the right decision. The judge was going to keep it in the city. If you think about the alternative, they tried to move the case, where would they go? And as Judge Williams said, it's not like 50 years ago where you could go to the Eastern Shore and maybe no one's heard of Freddie Gray. Now this case is known internationally. So the idea of moving it somewhere else where jurors would not know about this is pretty much impossible. So it seems like the right thing was to leave it in the city. And as the judge said, you can go through voir dire, which is when you ask jurors their opinions on different issues and figure out if there are impartial jurors for the case, for the trials.
So we're looking at presumably months of the trials unfolding.
Yes.
More motions, probably the trials themselves in series, one after the other, with perhaps gaps in between.
Well, it's interesting because also defendants are allowed the right to a speedy trial. It's one of your constitutional rights. So how are they going to get all these trials in within the allotted time they're allowed to have these trials? Now, maybe there's multiple judges that will hear the cases. Maybe there will be some settlements, although it's highly unlikely that there's going to be any plea deals between the officers. And people I've talked to have said they're going to be united on this till the end. How are they going to get these trials done in a prompt manner and not prejudice anyone? And you have, you know, six different trials. You have the same witnesses coming to each trial. You need to find jurors for each trial. I wouldn't want to be the first person on trial in this case, because I think that's sort of the test case now for all the rest of the subsequent trials. Any issues that might come up on appeal will come up on the first trial. Lawyers that we've talked to have said you want to be the sixth person tried in this series, because at that point you have five other times where witnesses have testified. You can point out inconsistencies in their statements. You have five trials to hone your arguments. So to go first now, knowing it's in the city and all the other stuff going on, that's going to be a challenge.
Are there any legal precepts involved in deciding the sequence of the trials?
That is a good question. We're still trying to find out exactly how it's going to work. And maybe that's what, like Kenny said, it's what we're going to talk about this afternoon, who goes first in the order of trials. If the same judge, Judge Williams, will hear all the trials, the logistics still need to be worked out. based on the ruling today and last week how they're going to do this.
But I was curious as to whether, I mean, obviously we all have scheduling issues all the time just in terms of when people are around and what their other commitments are, et cetera. But I didn't know whether the law tells the judge anything about the most serious charges should go first or the similar charges should go first or anything like that.
I think it's the judge's discretion in this case. But I'm sure if there is some law and the judge doesn't rule the correct way, there will be some appeals. And I don't think I agree that I think it's unlikely this is going to start next month based on the sheer amount of preliminary stuff that still needs to be resolved.
Back to the settlement, $6.4 million. How much of that is estimated that Billy Murphy and his son Hassan Murphy, who represented the Gray family, will get?
That is an excellent question. We haven't heard the details of how much they're going to get. Usually, in some cases, that you see 20-30% of the money will go to the attorneys. I'm sure this was worked out as part of the agreement, and I'm sure it'll come out at some point. But right now, we're not. It's still unclear how much they're going to. They will get paid, but we don't know how much yet.
And will we ever know?
We might find out. I mean, I'm sure we'll be asking. I'm sure the son will be asking. We'll try to find out how much they're going to get. Usually it's spelled out in these agreements, in court cases at least, usually see how much attorneys are going to get in the class action cases and some of the court settlements. But this case never went to court, so the documents probably could be considered confidential. But we'll dig. We'll try to find out. I'm sure that's a very interesting point of how much they're going to get.
Okay. I appreciate your walking us through it. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Danny Jacobs, legal editor of The Daily Record. We're going to take a short break here when we come back. What is the role of the press in the age of government surveillance, thousands of classified documents, secret courts? What is the responsibility of the press? Expose the truth at all costs? We speak to Hadden Carter III, author, journalist, former government spokesman, about the role of the press in the post-Snowden era. Stay with us for that. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cass, sitting in for Dan Rodericks today. In June 2013, news broke about a secret government surveillance program. The National Security Administration was collecting telephone data from millions of Americans with the help and cooperation of telecommunications companies. This news was followed by another revelation about government spying. The NSA was also collecting bulk data about America's online interactions. The program was called PRISM, and companies like Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and Yahoo were turning over data to authorities. Later that month, The Guardian newspaper revealed the identity of the man behind one of the most significant leaks in U.S. history, Edward Snowden. A 29-year-old former employee of the CIA and a defense contractor had stolen a trove of classified documents and turned them over to a select group of journalists. In a note accompanying that first set of documents, wait a minute, I'm trying to find that note and I'm out of order here. Snowden wrote, "My sole motive is to inform the public as to that which is done in their name and that which is done against them," close quote. There were three reporters whom Snowden worked with to expose the U.S. government surveillance: Barton Gellman of The Washington Post, Glenn Greenwald, a columnist for The Guardian, and investigative filmmaker Laura Portress. In an interview with Greenwald and Portress, Snowden said, quote, "The greatest fear I have regarding the outcome for America of these disclosures is that nothing will change. People will see in the media all of these disclosures. They'll know the lengths that the government is going to grant themselves powers unilaterally to create greater control over American society and global society, but they won't be willing to take the risks necessary to stand up and fight to change things, to force their representatives to actually take a stand in their interests," close quote. That's an interview Snowden gave to Greenwald and Portress. So today we explore the role of the press in the post-Snowden era. We're joined by Hadden Carter III, longtime journalist, former spokesman for the State Department during the Carter administration, most notably during the Iran hostage crisis that began in 1979. Hadden Carter began his career as a reporter in Greenville, Mississippi, working for his family's newspaper. He's reported for many major news outlets, including PBS, BBC, The New York Times. He's a four-time Emmy winner, recipient of the Edward R. Murrow Award for Broadcast Journalism. Hadden Carter, Welcome to the show.
It's good to see you and good to be here. Thanks.
We're really glad you're here. And of course, we ask you here today because of the chapter you wrote in the new book titled After Snowden, Privacy, Secrecy, and Security in the Information Age. The chapter you wrote was called The Press. Tell me what your first reaction was to the Snowden.
I thought he
leaks.
Ought to be shot. I was a typical absolute salute when the flag goes up kind of guy. I thought he had done damage beyond belief, and that in any case, what he had done violated the law and what I understood to be his responsibilities.
I think a lot of people reacted that way.
I think they did. The polls certainly seemed to say so. And then I started thinking about it, and then I started reading more, and I started actually beginning to understand what he thought as opposed to what he did and as to why he did it. And I listened to Bart Gellman, who I have great respect for, and Bart, who was the last thing in the world from some kind of crazed radical, had come up with enough information and points of view for me to think, all right, think about it again. By the end, I was asking myself, why was it it took a guy at a relatively low level, putting the word out to a press corps which had been such a patsy for so long that we never actually knew it was going on? The occasional story, and there were occasional stories, were then followed by silence. There was no follow-up in any number of times in which pieces of this came out before Snowden dumped this vast access on these three reporters. But what was really upsetting is that nobody in government who knew anything about it seemed to think there was a damn thing wrong with having a vacuum cleaner essentially cleaning out your privacy in the name of national security.
So your opinion of this, and let me just remind our listeners that you can be part of this conversation, and if you've gone through the same kind of zigzag that Hodding Carter's thinking has, from thinking this was terrible what Snowden did to thinking, no, somebody needed to do this, or the reverse, if you sort of didn't care that much and now you think really dumping all this classified information, even if it goes through the hands of reporters, is not the right thing to do. If you've got some thoughts about this, please be part of this conversation. Call us, 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I was struck by, frankly, the extremes of your view. I mean, you seemed really sure right away that this was a terrible thing, and now you seem really sure that it was a very good thing. And I think a lot of us are much less clear about this.
Believe me, I know that. I've gotten that reaction many times, and I have to say my first reaction was sort of the normal reaction. You are looking at something that seems to have been a direct assault upon our security. My latter one is more carefully arrived at, and for that reason, much more fundamental to what I think I'm a believe for a long time. This is a guy who may be as much of a patriot as any patriot I ever knew. The one thing he's not, and I notice that those who hate him have never been able to suggest he is, he's not an agent for another government. He didn't do it for money. So what did he do it for? I think he did it for what he said he did it for, which was to give the American people access to information about an assault on their basic liberties as guaranteed at least by the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution and perhaps by the First as well. So, yes.
I was struck when you walked through your thinking. His motives seemed to be tremendously important to you. Is that really the thing to judge?
I think what he did was, in the end of day, one of the most useful things a private citizen has done in a long time. He bared to the American people the atrocities that were being committed in their name. It is an atrocity to invade the castle of a person's home and essentially clean out his personal integrity. And that's what this whole scoping of information was, not by the millions, but by the tens of millions. It is exactly what it was that the founders had in mind when they accepted the idea of the Bill of Rights. You were going to stop this kind of thing. The king used to claim the right to do what the NSA was doing. A Democratic government is not supposed to do it. And if they do claim it, it has to be debated openly, and the American people have to say yes through their representatives, we accept it. It was a secret program. It might as well have been run some little totalitarian. I started to use language you can't use on.
Well, you use that kind of language in this chapter about the press. You
yes.
You have spent more time, more of your career as a journalist
yes.
than in government.
Yes. But I spent a hell of a lot of my time either working in government or carrying water for government agencies and government purposes. And in fact, look, just as vehemently as I'm opposed to that program, I am a guy who ordinarily, when he sees the flag, he salutes. I believe myself to be an old-fashioned kind of patriot. I'm not the new-fashioned kind of patriot who believes the main thing you do is that you say whatever the government says and you say, yes, sir. That ain't patriotism. That's stupidity. That's the loss of freedom.
But you are very critical of the press.
Yes. They have no business. They have no business playing hand in glove in a time not of wartime, but of really indeterminate and quite confusing time. They have no business playing hand in glove with the government and not letting the people know anything about programs which are thus far, by definition, of no real consequence. That is, again, if the government had something they could prove it was so useful for scooping up all this information, again, their favorite carriers in the media would have been fed enough information about the times that it just saved us from this or saved us from that we'd be hearing it. They can't because they don't. Or they don't because they can't.
One of the points you make that struck me is you said essentially Snowden's disclosures were inevitable, that if he mm-hmm. hadn't done it, someone else would probably soon. What do you base that conclusion on?
Well, one is that there are so many people who have top secret clearance out there working for private agencies and government agencies.
1.4 million top secret.
Yeah, some insane numbers. And you know what? They vary depending on what the source is, but it doesn't matter. But the other part of it is not the number of people who have access. It's the number of items of top secret information that are stored all over hell and gone, of which about 90% shouldn't even be classified, let alone top secret. You cannot put that much information out under lock and key in front of that many people and expect it to remain private. Never has, never will. And in this case, you are actually going to find some people who were going to sell it for money and others who were going to release it for patriotism. Snowden's not the only guy who's talked about excesses of the government in the past 20 years. He's the guy who actually released the most damning kind of material because he didn't just do a dump like Assange. He mediated through journalists.
I want to ask you about the distinction you draw between Julian Assange mm-hmm. of WikiLeaks and Snowden, but let's talk first to Nemo in Baltimore.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm okay, thanks. Maybe you can hear me a little bit better now. I just wanted to briefly comment on Edward Snowden and see what your guest had to say about that. He already touched up a little bit on it. But I was trying to say that the Internet basically was already exposing a lot of what the government was already doing before Edward Snowden came out. So people from the Internet basically, when he came and said that he had the documents and everything, and then they waited and everything like that, it just kind of seemed like he stole all the fame from the people that knew all this already.
I guess you know more than I know. And I mean this in all sincerity. I'm not being snarky. You probably do know more than I know about this area. I just simply am not aware of that kind of material that he made most clear about the extraordinary monitoring of private citizens by a government agency without public recognition. Didn't know that was running all over the Internet. If it was, somebody deserves a prize, but I just never saw it.
Nemo, I think part of what may have happened is, as I remember the sequence, and I don't have a very good memory, so it seems to me that we learned some of the leak, then we learned there had been this big leak, we learned about Edward Snowden, and then more things that he released through reporters as opposed to just sort of dumping them on the internet. And so it took, and we still don't know much, presumably, of what he walked away with. I mean, it hasn't all been made public yet, as I understand it. So
not a fraction.
It could be that that's why it seemed as if it was a sort of a slow motion release.
He meant it to be a slow motion release. He meant it to be something which would present what was perhaps the most damning single set of facts, and thought correctly that if he did a dump, which is what WikiLeaks did, then he would be taken with no more seriousness than any other showboater who just figured they had the right to do any damn thing they wanted to with any kind of information at all, to what other kind of damage it might actually literally do as opposed to the damage it's claimed. Government always claims that the world is coming to an end when information gets out there, which it's been trying to cover up. It doesn't matter what the occasion is. Pentagon Papers leak, oh my God, this is the most terrible blow to American security ever. It goes on and on and on. And he didn't want that one to happen on this, so he held the material fairly tight, and they did.
This is Midday. I'm Sheila Cass sitting in for Dan Rogers. We're talking to Hodding Carter III, a journalist, a former government spokesman, about the leaks by Edward Snowden and the impact on American security. And we'd like you to be part of the conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780. Email us at midday@wypr.org. So the primary distinction that you see between Edward Snowden and Julian Assange is that Assange was not a curated leak.
That's an important distinction. I think there was no evidence whatsoever that what Assange was doing was even something that caused him a great deal of second thought. After all, again, Snowden didn't walk out with those little bits. Yes.
Yeah.
And immediately just saw, call up two people and say, come get it. He agonized for quite a while. He thought about it a while. He was very slow in making contact and making sure that when he made contact, it was going to be a secure contact. I mean, again, if it had been as fast a kind of a deal as Julian Assange did, we wouldn't be having a discussion today about what do we know about Snowden, and we would still be trying to deal with the millions of items that he's never released, ever. Nobody even knows all the things he has. For all I know, the NSA is still trying to figure out everything that he might have. Every now and then, I'll debate somebody from over at that side of the world, and I'll be told that, by golly, he's responsible for this story or that story, and I'll say, prove it. Why do you say that? And the fact is, there is no proof, because that wasn't released, not through him.
You say that your experience in government, and you have some delightful pages about the leaking that you did when you were spokesman for the State Department. Lobbying, which you describe as lobbying things, occasionally lobbying a disclosure over the White House wall and getting pushback from the National Security Advisor. But you say your experience is that 90% of what was, at that point, all those decades ago, classified, could have been put out on the street with no problem.
Ms. Cass, you're hurting my feelings. Was it really all those decades ago?
It was decades ago,
yes.
I assure you, it was half a century ago.
I
was telling some people around here yesterday that I remember I was at the Washington Star when you were briefing about the hostage crisis, and it was probably maybe CNN. It was like the early days of ever broadcasting a briefing as opposed to waiting for the evening news. When you know what the networks did in those days was cut up.
Little
sound bites from the briefing, and there you were on live television, at least on cable. and you had said something important, and then you did what you would have often done in a State Department briefing in those days. You sort of leaned forward confidentially and said, "Now on background." And one of your aides came running out and said, "You can't go on background. You're on national television."
I was once doing a briefing when the Pakistani government did not adequately protect our embassy, and they burned it down there during that period. And I was briefing regularly, and so finally I said, "Okay, now we're shutting down. This is all on background." And they said, "Okay, what does the government really think about the Pakistani government?" And I said, "We are really pissed off. They have deliberately allowed our people to be put not only at risk, but our facilities to be broken down. And they betrayed us." Bob Novak, the old columnist, was sitting in the airport watching television. And he starts laughing. He said, "That boy is going to be fired before the show is over."
And you were not.
I wasn't. Well, because everybody in there, the other reporters, all knew that they had been told to turn it off. And that this guy was one of those, "Here comes Johnny," you know, one note from some outfit who did not regularly cover the State Department. And he was just avidly doing things that he thought would make his name.
At any rate, getting back to the point, and you said even then that what you observed in your perch in government was that a whole lot of stuff was being classified that did not need to be. We've been talking about this a lot. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the late New York senator, made a cause out of this, but then, you know, unfortunately hasn't been able to carry it on because he died. When are we going to address this question?
I don't know.
It's an issue right now with Hillary Clinton's email servers, stuff
Look.
That... It's being declared classified that apparently, she says, was not at the time she was doing emails about it.
Well, selective declassification is not a specialty, I would add, of Mr. Snowden's. It's been done repeatedly. The biggest leaks of all of classified material, of course, come from the top, and they come regularly to do the business of whoever is in power. Violates the law, but as Richard Nixon once famously said, if the president does it, it's not illegal. Well, that's baloney, but it doesn't matter. It is a thesis that many people think applies to that kind of leaking. I'm going to say it because I say it so often that I love to hear me saying the same thing again. It's the only thing I can remember anymore. 90% of everything I ever saw that was classified that came across my desk, everything from what came from across the agency to what came from the White House, whatever, had no business being classified at all. Virtually none of it had a business being classified top secret. What classification is for is power. In the bureaucratic games of Washington, I got my little pile of material you can't get, blah, blah. And of course, it is also to make sure that the American people are not made privy to a lot of baloney. But most of it is just a game. Five commissions, the last one being, of course, Daniel Patrick Moynihan's, came to the same conclusion. When you classify everything, nothing can be kept classified. Once you create a system which is obviously on its merits a subject of contempt because it is so utterly out of control, then it makes no sense to say I can control the releasing on it because you can't convince people you're serious.
We're going to take a break here in a minute, but let me throw a question at you before we do, and that is, before you made this manifesto in favor of what Snowden did, have you looked at the impact of his disclosures so far? Would you say that they've had almost no impact?
Let's see.
The disclosures.
Let's see what the impact is. We no longer have diplomatic relations with Germany. I think that's the first one, right? Because it was revealed that we had been putting the little scrubber on Ms. Merkel, and that was going to ruin our relations. We are no longer have any kind of agents anywhere around. The reason I know that is that that's what people say, that people have been killed. But you know what? If that were true, we would by now have been told that that were true with something more identifiable, because in past times of leaks, when it endangered agents to the point of extinction, the agencies, with good reason, would make it very public, very fast, to try to bring great pressure. The fact is, almost always, there's nothing that follows a strong assertion any more valid than another strong assertion. Proof is simply not offered. And if you're not able to prove your assertion that you're destroying America's security with these leaks, then, like the little boy who cried wolf, you get to be called a little boy crying wolf.
We're going to take a break here. We've got some callers who want to be part of this conversation. We'll go to them when we get back. What do you think? Do you think Edward Snowden did the right thing? Are you worried about how much gets classified and who's doing it and what the impact is? You can call us at 410-662-8780, and we'd love to have you join the conversation. Also, we're going to take a break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast here, sitting in for Dan Rodericks. We're speaking with journalist and former spokesman for the State Department under the Carter administration, Hodding Carter III. We're talking about a chapter he wrote about the press in a new book, After Snowden, Privacy, Secrecy, and Security in the Information Age. And before we get to our callers, let me remind listeners, you can call in too, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wipr.org. Before we do any of that, I keep thinking to ask you, how is President Carter doing?
I wish I could tell you that I intimately know the answer to that every day. I would just say, in general, the man is incredible right now. I mean, and what he's going through, look, I'm 10 years younger than he is. People 50 years younger than him could not have gone through what he's going through and present themselves in such a vigorous and straightforward way. I think that one of the nice things that's happened to Jimmy Carter is that he gets his eulogies before he's dead.
Yeah, that crossed my mind when he had that amazing press conference last month.
And the reaction to it, and if anybody deserved it, to get some of the reassessment that has been underway now, more than him, I don't know who it is. So I would say he's not happy about his physical condition. But he's got to be very happy about what the reaction has been from a lot of people about their thinking about him anew.
Yeah, there's a transparency there that ties in with the rest of our conversation. Let's talk to Larry in Frederick. Hello, Larry. Welcome to Midday.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you so much for this conversation. I think it's an important one, an interesting one. My question is about, I was wondering if the guests could talk about the criticism Mr. Snowden gets for not taking the established internal route, perhaps to superiors, with this his criticism of government spying, and how it relates to previous stories of whistleblowers who did try that, such as Bill Binney or Tom Drake, and had a great damaging effect to their careers and their lives. And I'll take my answer off there. Thank you so much.
Thank you for calling, Larry. What about the argument that he should have gone through channels?
If you live in an environment in which you have seen it repeatedly proved that if you go to your superiors with this kind of story or this kind of complaint or this kind of concern, the first thing that's going to happen to you is they're going to crucify you one way or the other. All those names that the caller just mentioned are people who went the orthodox road or who tried to go the orthodox road or were rebuffed for going it. And what you get for that is what whistleblowers get all the time, which is, you're the enemy, son, and we're going to get you. If we don't get you right now, we're going to get you later. And he knew that. And that's the terrible thing. There's a whistleblower down at Chapel Hill who did some great work about something which was a disgrace to the university, and so they basically sort of drummed her out of town. She wasn't the problem. What she was talking about was a problem. Well, it's the same thing with Snowden. And he knew correctly that if he went the other route, one, he'd be cut off for good from anything, and second, that he couldn't get the material out anyway, because they'd be on top of him as soon as he took his complaint.
Well, your point in terms of he has gotten quite some huge disclosures out. His career is as destroyed as the case is.
Yeah,
you describe. I mean, he's basically a man without a country in Russia.
Yeah, that's a fascinating thing in itself, but which is another question. But he clearly didn't care about his career being destroyed. I'm going to say it again. He did what he did because he thought the nation that he loved deserved to be saved from its worst instincts. Our worst instincts is that we behave like yapping animals, terrified by the things that go bark in the night. It's not that their terrorists aren't terrible. It's not that they're not evil. It's not that we don't have to contend with them in every way that makes sense. But come on, man. We've been in much worse situations in our history, in our lifetime, than a bunch of terrorists from the Middle East. Unless you think, of course, that the Soviet Union was a joke, or that Nazi Germany was a joke, or that we have simply now encountered real evil, to quote one of our former presidents, or maybe two of our former presidents. And now, only because it's so evil, do we get to do things which are so reprehensible in terms of our Constitution.
Let's talk to Chad in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday, Chad.
Hello?
Chad?
Oh, wait, I'm back. Hello?
Hello, Chad. We're waiting for your thoughts.
Oh, sorry, my phone went crazy. So I was basically a comment, kind of question on how you feel about the media. I felt vilified the NSA in large part by doing a lousy job of explaining what metadata really is, since it was simply a collection of phone bills. It wasn't a recording of conversations, which got everyone seemed to believe. So the belief on the street wasn't matching the reality, but that fueled a lot of fear and anger towards the government that I felt was really misplaced. And I felt media and the news did not fulfill their role on educating the American populace.
Huh. Interesting, Chad. You may have heard it differently than I felt like I had reporters explaining to me ad nauseum that this was metadata, not voices. But let's see what Hadden Carter says.
Again, I appreciate the distinction. And it's a nice one, and I mean that in a sarcastic way. We make nice distinctions to hide the fact that behind this accumulation may not be a voice. It is, however, the access to everything that the person was giving voice to. Because you pull up first the fact of the existence of something, and then, when necessary, you pull up the thing itself. It is simply gives me no comfort at all, and by the way, they have, of course, gone beyond just, they have, makes me laugh when I have to even say this, that they've gone beyond just the accumulation of phone records. And it's been going on for a very long time. It's what governments do. We used to call it something else, bugging, or any number of things, and you were supposed to have court orders for it, and they say they have court orders for it. The problem is that the press is about as good as it has access to information to be good about. And if you are dealing with what amounts to a total 100% hangout, to quote another president, on information which is of interest to a public that elects and controls supposedly as public citizens, if there's essentially a vast iron curtain between the people and the explanation about what is being done, then of course you're going to have some bad stories. But you see, going back to my real concern, is not that the press does bad stories. It is that the media, for the most part, did not have a taste for going straight at the government and saying, how dare you, sir? What are you doing? And again, some of the best people in Washington, which my interviewer knows full well, dined out on dining out with people of power. And you don't want to cut off access to them by being unpleasant in the way you approach some of their work.
Let me put you in touch with the comments from Frank in Hampstead, Maryland, who wrote us to say, and by the way, others can write us too at midday at wypr.org or give us a call at 410-662-8780. Frank said, I thought Mr. Snowden was guilty of breaking the law in the beginning, and I still think he is guilty of breaking the law. Number one, who is Edward Snowden to decide what is wrong and right? He has no view of the larger picture. He substituted his judgment. What does he know? He was a low-level flunky. Number two, proponents of Mr. Snowden say that this program should have been debated by the American people. Excuse me, you cannot run this story on page one. There is a need for secrecy when spying, and members of the House and Senate did know what was going on. Third, Mr. Snowden should never return to the United States unless he is wearing handcuffs for his trial. He is no hero or patriot.
Good. I know each one of those points, and I respect the point of view behind them to some degree. It's based on fallacies. But first, of course he broke the law. Of course he ought to come back, and he ought to face trial for breaking the law. He broke a law. He stole material. And that is the subject. I would think Mr. Snowden would be happy to come back and face trial for having stolen it, if, of course, that trial was not confined by a court to certain areas of discussion and only those certain areas of discussion. He'd be happy to come back and say why he thinks he's entitled. And by the way, we are not a nation in which a cat cannot look at a king. We are not a nation in which if I tell you the government does it, then I tell you shut up. You don't get to question it. We're a nation which, to the contrary, has always elevated pretty high the right of people to contest what government does. And who elected him? What was it? Another famous guy in Washington said, declassifier in chief. He elected himself. And you know what? We all do. Who elected the press to be declassifiers in chief? The reason they adopted the Bill of Rights was that we do not have kings and we are not cats and we get to look and say and then take the consequences. But you remind me of the people who thought that the sit-in people had no right to break the law because it was a law. And it was the law and they broke it. So the best thing to prove that he was doing it for good motives is to let him come back and face trial. And he will come back and face trial if, of course, his lawyers are allowed to make a defense that goes beyond the narrow range of the real offense and go into the material. They're never going to let him do that. Matter of fact, one of these days, as I say in the chapter, Putin will grow bored with him. I mean, his virtues for Putin are about extinct, and he will be expelled. And then we will, of course, try to make sure that he comes back here for trial. And I assume that if he has any sense at all, he will at least be surrounded by lawyers when the boys in the black helicopters come to get him, wherever he's been deposited by Mr. Putin, who is no friend, I would add, of open government either. And then we'll see what's there. And I would hope that those who do believe in what he has done will make a unholy ruckus if he is suddenly put off in that wonderful place of permanent rendition, Guantanamo, and be the last guy sitting there, the man without a country in a place without a constitutional underride, which is called Guantanamo. And it's entirely possible they'll put him there.
I want to mention before we're out of time, you're in town. You're here in Baltimore for a conference today at Johns Hopkins University, the Senior Executive Cybersecurity Conference, co-sponsored by Johns Hopkins and Comprehensive Applied Security Solutions, or COMPASS. What was your main point?
My main point was that I was utterly disorganized because they had to move the site because things went wrong with the air conditioning. And so I didn't get to emphasize my main point. My main point, frankly, is I wish I could have stayed because there are people who are really expert in this, both from NSA and from private sector media and the like, talking about cybersecurity with real knowledge. And I particularly like to listen to people with real knowledge talk about why it is that it's okay to do what they do.
Well, we are about to release you. We're very grateful for your spending this time with us. Thank you so much.
I loved being here, and I love seeing you again.
Hodding Carter. In Midday's second hour, we listen back to Dan's conversation with longtime science journalist who studied individuals with complex neurological disorders. We hear about Alzheimer's, ecstatic epilepsy, and schizophrenia, as well as a rare disorder that causes the delusional belief that one is dead. That's in the second hour. Dan Rodericks will be back tomorrow with a news roundup that includes lots of news this week about the Freddie Gray trial. And we hope you'll be back, too. I'm Sheila Cass, sitting in for Dan Rodericks. Thanks for being with us on Midday.